You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds, like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
Feel like who Art Ed? Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's
off
to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today, I have Rebecca Potts Aguirre, the host of Teaching Artist Podcast, a fellow art teacher and an art maker, just doing all the things these days. Thank you for finding time to do this thing and join me on the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate your willing to step in. I had a last minute cancellation and I asked you because I have been listening to you for a while and I highly recommend the Teaching Artist podcast to anybody who's listening. I knew that you just seem like the nicest person to reach out and ask an imposition of. And I appreciate that you're willing to join me to talk about Cause today, who I know you, like I, kind of have mixed feelings and mixed reactions about.
Yeah.
So to get into Cause and his background, because just like on your podcast, I like to start with a little bit of context and the backstory. He was born November 4th, 1974, in Jersey City, New Jersey. And his progression seems like very direct. Like I've read that as a child, he was kind of inspired by the graffiti around him and would draw on paper like his own renditions of the great graffiti he saw in the community. And his friends liked it. And I mean, you know, like I do, just as that kid, that's kind of that first bit of validation is your friends and classmates like it and want you them to draw it for you and stuff like that, or draw it for them. And so then he continued with that love of graffiti. 1990s, he adopted the name Cause, which he just says he liked the way the letters looked together. I always find that weird when you say, like, your name has no deep meaning.
Yeah. Very strange.
Well, it's the first point where I, like, take a pause for a timeout in that biography because, like, Cause, just phonetically, I think there's a cause behind theirs. There's a purpose, you know? And just knowing him, like, I also see the association almost like Klaus or something, because I think he was a big fan of Klaus Oldenburg and other artists in the pop art movement and stuff like that, which, looking at his work, no real shock there. But he adopted the name Cause, started doing tagging and other graffiti. He goes to school, gets a BFA from the School of Visual Arts in New York, and he became a freelance animator. I guess he worked with Jumbo Pictures, and he did some animation, like painting backgrounds and stuff for Disney, like 101 Dalmatians and Doug, which was one of my favorite cartoons as a child. And I guess Daria also, which is again tracking with my backstory and my love of cartoons and animation as a child. What I find really interesting about that, though, is like Doug and Daria at first glance seem like such different pieces tonally. Are you familiar with those cartoons?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally grew up then, too. So grew up with those.
Yeah. And, you know, for listeners who are not familiar, Doug is, you know, this cartoon that was just very earnest in its depiction of like a, I think he was a fourth grader, and just looking at the world through the eyes of that child, and just very, very sweet and wholesome. And Daria was extremely popular on MTV. And I guess, again, it was life through the lens of the child, you know, I mean, but an older child, a teenager. So it was extremely sarcastic and all the adults knew nothing, right?
Yeah, so cynical, so angsty.
So cynical and so angsty, yeah. And and so much in a way that, like, as a teenager, I remember looking at it and thinking, like, wow, this is really insightful. And it's funny because it really captured that lens of a teenager's worldview, where the show, to me, felt like it thought it was smarter than it was. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was like this ego and cynicism and sarcasm that, like, it was just, I don't know, missing the boat in some ways, but in another level, almost like perfect for that teenage mindset.
Yeah.
And so while he's doing that as his day job to pay the bills, he's also making graffiti at night, and mostly what's often referred to as subvertisements. You know, he's doing things that are a little bit subversive, but based on pop culture and the sort of commercial stuff, like the billboard ads and the ads on bus shelters and all those things you see all around. He's doing basically spoofs or parodies of those. And I think what's interesting is, like, we see that story play out from so many artists. The most common, you know, connections that people would draw would be like Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat, who both got their starts as street artists, as graffiti artists, and then made their way into the quote-unquote fine art world. I guess Cause kind of started with, I think he was big in Japan at first with the toys that he was making. Am I right in that?
Yeah, I was reading something that he got in somehow. He was traveling to Japan just because he liked it, and he got in somehow with a toy maker there, and yeah, that kind of the marketability of those toys helped him get into galleries because they were basically like, we can sell this.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like Japan has a really strong pop art connection in a lot of stuff. Like I think of Takashi Murakami with the super flat and the way that pop culture is elevated and mass produced. And there's that blurring of the lines that I actually personally really like about artists is when we cross the borders that seem really arbitrary, distinguishing between the quote unquote high and low, the what's good for the gallery and what's good for the teenager's poster in their bedroom. I don't think art should necessarily be rigidly categorized. And we see that in Japan quite a bit. There's a long tradition. Well, I mean, second half of the 20th century is long by my standards, of breaking down those barriers and embracing the pop culture. And so since then, he's really just been doing a lot of stuff that is getting more and more acclaim in the gallery context, and he's working with, you know, fashion designers and toy manufacturers, but also doing like monumental sculptures and things for the museum. He's making paintings that are selling for, you know, seven or eight figures, which to me just seems mind-boggling.
Yeah.
His most iconic figure is probably his you know, his rendition of Mickey Mouse with the X's for the eyes and the bones replacing the ears. And those are kind of common symbols and marks that he makes across his figures that's part of his style. Whether it's SpongeBob or Mickey Mouse or Homer Simpson, he's putting X's on the eyes. That's one of the hallmarks of his style that helps to make it recognizable as his signature work and not just a copy of those pop culture icons. And I think in this one, because the biography is relatively short, I mean, the guy is only like 45 years old, and he didn't take like a winding path to becoming an artist. I mean, from the time he was a child, he liked street art, and then he started making street art and became celebrated for it. I do think it's worth talking about the art market. And I would love to hear your thoughts and insights on this. But one of the things that I have noticed is his work seems to be selling for what to me seem like insane prices. His highest grossing piece, I guess, would be the Cause album. It was estimated. It was expected to sell for $1 million, which to me seems like a very, very large price. But it ended up on auction fetching $14.8 million. And the piece is his version of the Simpsons version of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album cover. It's mind-boggling to me. But mm-hmm. what do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, that piece especially, I mean, it's like layer upon layer of appropriation. And that price tag is, yeah, I agree, totally mind-boggling. And I mean, I guess I see he's got this like appeal to, he's worked with several celebrities and a lot of big brands, and that I think that is what pushes the price tag up so much, that there's this like, somehow he has this reputation. And it's one of those weird things about the art market where like the art can be not so good and still sell for $14.8 million because of the artist's reputation.
Yeah, an artist's reputation is an interesting thing because, you know, in the art world, there's traditionally there were certain gatekeepers, you know, whether it was the curators in the museums and other things that like basically stamp it as okay. And that's why, mm-hmm. you know, Jackson Pollock stumbling around a canvas on the floor of his barn and spilling paint on it, people will pay millions of dollars for it because people said, oh, no, that's not, you know, an accidental spill. He purposefully spilled it on the canvas and it was brilliant and groundbreaking. And in some ways, Cause has had those stamps of validity, even though arguably he's doing something that is not quote unquote highbrow or sophisticated. He's basing it off of SpongeBob, or in this case, the Simpsons, who are referencing the Beatles. And yet he, you know, he has been recognized as good at what he does. And so people just don't question it. One of the other odd things that I always find about like the contemporary art market is I always used to think that, you know, the old adage was when an artist dies, their work becomes much more valuable because now there's going to be no new stuff that's produced. But the art market has become very much a vehicle for like just insanely wealthy people to park their money and then to, mm-hmm. you know, trade amongst themselves. And it almost becomes like this weird commodity that is used as an investment vehicle. And mm-hmm. because of that, and Cause himself has said he finds this a little bit ridiculous, that like he doesn't think his work is worth that much. So I agree with him on that. because I don't think any painting on canvas is worth $15 million. Like just I don't see it. Like I think it's I appreciate what he did in a lot of ways. But what's interesting is in that mode with, you know, people using art as an investment tool, I guess there's a bias towards contemporary art, and we're seeing contemporary art becoming much more valuable because of the fact that you can't really forge it as easily. Mm-hmm. And you might think, like, well, it seems pretty easy to forge a cartoon drawing. And arguably it is, except for the fact that the artist who created it is living and able to say, no, I didn't make that copy of The Simpsons. I made this copy of The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easier to track the ownership and everything like that. So, like, I think of the another just insanely overpriced artwork. Do you remember Salvador Mundi?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Da Vinci piece that sold for, what was it, $400 million? Something like that?
Insane. Yeah, some wild number.
Yeah, it set all sorts of records and made headlines maybe 2 years ago. And the reason that it made headlines was not just the price tag, but the fact that a lot of people say it wasn't actually painted by Da Vinci. And the fact that mm-hmm. that's called into question could make that one of the biggest financial blunders of all time, because someone paid almost $500 million for it, and it may not be the real deal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like it or not, stuff that's more contemporary, even if the artist has passed away, like a Basquiat or Keith Haring or someone like that, because it's in the modern era, there's much better record keeping of all of that stuff, and it's much easier to authenticate it. But I do want to get more into the specific artwork and not just a cold, cynical look at the art market as it stands today, because I think Cause is doing some stuff that is interesting, and you said it's appropriation upon appropriation. And for listeners not familiar with the term, appropriation is what we talk about when we say, like, an artist is claiming something from the outside world and taking it as their own and using it as a symbol in their work. Most often it's talked about in that negative context of cultural appropriation. And I mean, I feel like I'm bullying the conversation. I don't want to be mansplaining to you. But can you share with our listeners, like, what are we talking about when we talk about cultural appropriation? Because that's also a sensitive topic and a hot topic that we should mm-hmm. probably discuss a little bit.
Yeah. So that's usually when someone who's not from a culture takes something from a different culture and kind of uses it as their own, or, you know, puts it, you know, as an artist could be putting it in their work with no context. And, you know, maybe I'm making a dream catcher, for instance. That's kind of a popular one. And as a not Indigenous person, I'm making this dream catcher and saying, like, oh, isn't this pretty? I'm going to hang it in my window, and having no sort of context around what the use or the history or, you know, why am I making this thing?
Yeah. And yeah. I think the key thing that you talked about there was the context, because mm-hmm. I think there's a difference between, you know, what we talk about as appreciating another culture mm-hmm. and appropriating a culture. I think of, you know, I appreciate work from all sorts of different cultures, and I learn from those works, and I integrate some of those strategies that I learn from different artists from all parts of the world into mm-hmm. my own work. But I don't pretend that my creation is the same as what they did and has the same significance to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to be mindful of when the context shifts and when something is inspired by something, but takes on a new meaning because of who's producing it and what their intentions are and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there's an example. You know, you talked about context, and I think you said, like, taking sort of parts of something. And I feel like you can learn from and be inspired by something by taking maybe one technique that this artist used, or one thinking about the theme that they're working with, Like instead of, you know, making those sugar skulls, instead of actually like creating, replicating what those artists are creating, thinking about the theme, thinking about like honoring the dead or, you know, whatever it is that thematically is in that work is maybe a way to shift away from that appropriation.
Yeah, exactly. Because as artists, we are constantly influenced by the things around us, but it doesn't become your own work of art until you put your own creative spin on it. And I think that's the difference between inspiration and appropriation. And that's part of the controversy that has landed cause in some hot water in some circles. Not so much with like the quote unquote cultural appropriation, but like getting back to the cause album, you know, as you said, it's appropriation on top of appropriation on top of appropriation. And it's not problematic from like the racial lens, the way that the examples of, you know, the sugar skulls or the way that sometimes mandalas are reduced to radial symmetry and stuff like that. But what he's doing there is he made his like almost straight up copy of the Simpsons parody of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album cover.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
The only real significant difference is he did his stylistic shift of putting the X's on the eyes and the bones coming out of the head, which in some ways is probably also a nod to The Simpsons, because now that I'm thinking about it, Sideshow Mel has the bone coming out of his hair. But as we look at this piece, because I do want to do a little bit of a more of a dive, like what are you seeing in here and what's jumping out at you for better or worse? What do you see here?
Well, I mean, one thing that a positive with Koss is I read something about him, like someone termed him as like a great colorist. And I was like, I kind of have to agree. I don't want to agree, but his colors. And I feel like in this piece, it's not as, like, I'm not as drawn to the way he's using color as in some of his other work. And maybe that's partly because it's like almost a direct copy. He's kind of using the colors that the Simpsons creators used. Yeah, there's that element of color, and then just like the flatness of each sort of shape. I mean, I feel like that goes back to his background, where he got his start in both graffiti and in like illustration, sort of like the backgrounds for animation. You see that stuff coming through. But I also feel like the controversy, like, I almost want to say he intentionally created this controversy, and that's a big part of why the price tag was so high.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think there's no shortage of artists who seek attention and who court controversy. Yeah. And I think in some ways, even the idea of doing like a straight up copy of someone else's work feels like it's been done. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. we've seen plenty of people who are taking found images and stuff. I mean, Andy Warhol was doing that for, you know, decades, in a different way. Mm-hmm. And in this piece, the Cause album, I think part of what he's doing is playing off of people's love of pop culture. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that he chose The Simpsons. It's one of the longest running series of all time. And, you know, it is beloved around the world. And so right off the bat, he's taking a subject matter that's going to be a cultural touchstone. And again, it's referencing another act that was one of the biggest of all time. I mean, the Beatles were legendary. And so he's taking essentially two really major pop cultural icons and synthesizing them and then just putting his own minimal marks on there in order to gain that attention. It kind of reminds me of when book publishers will take a popular cartoon show and then just be like, well, here's the book version of it, because they know an audience will buy it just for that reason.
Mm-hmm. As evidenced by the millions of frozen things in my home.
Yes. Yeah. As a parent who has to read those books, I'm sometimes pained by it, because they're not always as interesting as the books that are created for the sake of being a book, you know? Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel that way about this piece. And so if you'll mm-hmm. indulge me, I want to talk a little bit about a second piece of his, because you said you have to grudgingly admit he's a good colorist. And are you on the slides right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you see that second one, the Things That Comfort from 2015? Mm-hmm. And that's a silk screen on paper. And I think this is an example of the work that I find much more interesting. I like the Cause album because it gives us that insight into sort of the art world and the art market and what buttons artists will push in order to gain attention and to gain acceptance into that market. And I don't even necessarily begrudge someone that, because I think there's a legit skill involved in reading the room and reading the market and understanding what people will respond to. Mm-hmm. But as a work of visual art, I find this more interesting. And so I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about this one, The Things That Comfort from 2015. It's a silk screen. What are you seeing here? What's jumping out at you?
Yeah, just his colors. Like, this is one that I'm not sure I would actually want this hanging on my wall, but I would if I had to choose between the two of them, this one is highly preferable, because it is a little more minimal. It is, you know, just the colors again, like that mix of, there's the like neons in there that just play perfectly with that deeper purple, and his use of color, his use of line. Like, I feel like these sort of outlines that are in here on the, you know, around the body, the arms, the legs, almost like reference his graffiti background a little bit. This one's much more interesting to me. And the Simpsons, so the Thinking of the Cause album, I saw a bunch of paintings he did, I think were much smaller, that were like very minimal, just taking like a piece of like the Simpsons hair. So it would be like a flat background and like part of Marge's hair and then part of like Bart's hair. And those were much more interesting to me, just these very minimal like color studies almost. I feel like this one that we're looking at now, The Things That Comfort, is somewhere in between there.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting as you talk about those smaller scale studies, I was reminded when I've looked at his body of work of those like close cropped things, it feels like a very modern approach. And when I say modern, I'm talking in the art history sense, meaning like 100 years ago, because artists and art historians and critics use words in ways that make no sense to most people. When we talk about the modern art period, we're talking about like early to mid 20th century. And in that time, part of the idea of abstract art was focusing in on small details and removing a lot of context. Like, I mean, that's what Georgia O'Keeffe was doing in a lot of her work, was taking those macro shots, blowing them up so that we see these tiny little things that are often unnoticed. And Kaws is doing that in a way that becomes a little bit more contemporary with the color scheme that he's using, the way he flattens things, the way he plays with the fluorescence, as you talked about. And I think that's one of the things that when I look at Kaws's work, part of the reason that I wanted to talk about two pieces is because I felt like I couldn't ignore the Kaws album that grabbed so much attention. But I also wanted to talk more about the stuff that shows like he does more than just copy. And with this one, I see a silhouette that to me, I recognize as like the Snoopy silhouette. But within that silhouette, it's this abstraction that's completely different. The way the colors shift, as you talked about, the strong line work, it in some ways reminds me of like Ramiro Brateau, another contemporary artist who does things with pop culture, but also bringing in a cubist influence. And here I see a little bit of almost like mixed perspective and simplification of the forms and all of that. That becomes a little bit more interesting to me because I feel like, and again, it's appropriation upon appropriation. It's referencing all of these styles that have come before. But here it feels like he's mixed it up in a way that's new. And I think that's what a lot of our current culture is. It's a remix culture. You know, we're building off the ideas of people who came before us. I mean, that's what culture always is. But I think lately it's become almost amped up by the mass media and all of that, and the fact that it's really hard to imagine anything that hasn't been done before at this point. You know?
And we're contemporary art is, you know, where we are now with art, there's not like one movement. Like we went from art historically from, you know, there's the impressionists, and if you live in this time, you are an impressionist. And then there's, you know, whatever like movement that exists at the moment is the one big movement. And there might be one or two little like subverting movements, but now there's, I mean, I can't even name all the different sort of movements that are happening. There's so many things going on and so much like referencing what's come before.
Yeah. And I think in some ways it's really interesting and exciting that now we're not limited to that sort of homogenizing effect of cultural gatekeepers saying like, this is what's in vogue right now. This is what's in fashion, because the internet is democratizing, and I'm getting way too much into the art speak as I'm conjugating nouns. But I think people's different perspectives are being elevated and they're accessible to everybody. And, you know, we see things like Instagram opening the doors so that everybody can see those different artists. And, you know, through other social media, whether it's Instagram or Twitter or YouTube, like all those artists have a direct channel to their audience. And sometimes the audience has a direct channel to them. Kaws is on Instagram and he is bringing his art to the masses. And I think it is interesting that he is bringing these things together in a way that is deliberate, that works very well aesthetically. I mean, he shows some restraint with the way that he has the clean white background. Like with all of those colors, he recognizes that it needs that neutral, the white space to create that counterbalance, to create that contrast, to give the eye a place to rest, You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways he is a very strong visual artist. And I just keep going back and forth on where I land on his work, whether I like it or hate it. And I feel like it's a little bit of both depending on the piece.
Yeah. I watched a couple of videos with him and I was the same. I was like, I love the colors. I feel like there is a lot. He's referencing so many things. There is a lot of meaning. Like, he makes now also these giant sculptures. And there was a series of sculptures that I loved that were, I think, called like Holiday or Vacation, something like that, where he's basically putting these giant sculptures with the X's on their eyes, like mm-hmm. out in the landscape. So then they become sort of this like land art, lounging, like, you know, a 30-foot Mickey Mouse figure lounging on a mountain, you know.
And I want to live in a world that has that, you know.
Right. But then what killed me was he kept saying, like, there's no meaning. There's no, I don't have any intentions with this. I just wake up and do what I want to do that day. I'm like, no, you don't. Is that just your shtick? Is that what sells? Like, clearly there's meaning and there's thought behind this.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think, you know, we've had iterations of that thought expressed by a number of people talking about like art for art's sake and sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, telling people to just enjoy the sensory experience and just, mm-hmm. you know, see the cartoon figure lounging on a mountain and say, like, that's just fun. And mm-hmm. honestly, as I look at the world today, I kind of think fun and enjoyment is a good enough purpose. And in some ways, mm-hmm. I think it's a better purpose than a lot of stuff that's supposedly so deep and meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I could see making the argument that, like, I don't want to deconstruct the piece so much that it robs it of that fun, because the primary goal is to spark that joy.
But he never even says that. Like, just say, instead of saying there's no meaning, say, like, it's just fun, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. I guess I'm channeling a little bit of my own biases there, because I'm looking for some validation that his work will reinforce my worldview that sometimes it's okay to just have fun with a piece.
It totally is.
And I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre? British for the bathroom.
Yeah,
there's the Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm going to have to say the lab. The idea that, like, I don't love it all, but there's things we can learn from it.
Yeah, I would agree. I can definitely learn a lot from, you know, his color choices and his composition. But I think I would actually probably put this one in the loo, just because I feel like I don't need to keep it around that much. And if he says there's no meaning, I'll take him at his word and say that, you know, it's a throwaway cultural piece that might be enjoyable but doesn't need to be studied and doesn't need to be maintained for the ages. But somebody that I can learn from and should be sticking around for the ages, I want to say thank you very much, Rebecca Potts Aguirre. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me this morning. And I would encourage everybody, please listen to your podcast, Teaching Artist Podcast. And should we throw out all of your promotion here? We've got teachingartistpodcast.com, rebeccapotts.com, and I will include links to your websites and your social media in the show notes.
Thank you so much, Kyle. This was great. It was a lot of fun to dig into an artist I actually didn't know a lot about before. So
I always appreciate your taking the time, your flexibility on the schedule, as you have been talking about self-care and taking time for yourselves and giving yourself grace to take a break. And I, at the last minute, asked you to come join me for this because I'm not quite ready to give myself grace and take a break and be late on a show. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted. If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes, on Twitter at WoodArtEd, and on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.